Hello and welcome to At Home This Morning, our magazine for older listeners, which we hope will also be of interest to the not so old. I'm Richard Davis, and I hope you'll stay with me for the next hour. Well, this edition of At Home This Morning is a special one, in which we're presenting an extended feature on the local Brighton and Hove branch of the Samaritans, who celebrate their 50th anniversary this year. But we'll also be hearing from the Royal British Legion about the events in Brighton and Hove which are planned to mark the 100th anniversary of the armistice which ended the First World War. And that anniversary takes place on Sunday, November the 11th. In amongst all this, there'll be some music. Anyway, without further ado, let's hear about the Samaritans. Here's Maya Davis.
In the immediate aftermath of World War II, a young clergyman in London, Chad Vara, decided to make himself available to anyone who wanted to talk about feelings of despair and distress which might lead them to take their own lives. They could either come to see him or they could phone him. Well, to cut a long story short, the job got too much for one man, and he noticed that sometimes just talking to the parish volunteers who were making the tea was quite enough. And so he trained his parish volunteers to take calls. Much to his annoyance, the group he started was nicknamed Samaritans by the tabloid press, and the name stuck. Nearly 70 years on, Samaritans is a national organisation with 201 branches in the UK and Ireland, and the Brighton and Hove branch is 50 years old this year. They're having a party to celebrate. We've been invited to it, and we've been invited to interview a few key past and present Samaritans. Before we got involved in the party, we started by talking to the director of Brighton and Hove Samaritans, and I asked her how people contact the Samaritans now and whether it's still by phone or visit.
No. People can also contact us by email and text message, and many do. We have a correspondence branch who deal with letters from callers. This is more popular than you might think and is mostly used by prisoners.
Now, if people living in Brighton or Hove phone the Samaritans, will they have to give their names and identify themselves?
People are generally given the opportunity to give their names, and most do, but there's no requirement to give your name. We'll listen to you, whoever and whatever you say.
And will they talk to someone who's in Brighton or Hove?
That's unlikely. Since the introduction of our new phone system, calls come from all over the country.
Well, that's a bit of a surprise. Anyway, how much do calls to the Samaritans cost?
Well, since September 2015, Samaritans have got a free phone number, 116 123. This number is free to call from landlines or from mobiles.
OK, well, that's quite a lot about the Samaritans. Now, how about you? You're the director of the Brighton and Hove branch, so what does that involve?
What does it not involve? I'd like to say first that I don't do this all on my own. I have a brilliant team of 8 deputy directors, as well as an amazing group of 9 trustees, some of whom are also deputy directors. The deputies head up essential areas such as training and recruitment, volunteer support, and fundraising, things like that. I spend quite a bit of time in the branch, as I've got an office there, and I believe it's good to be available for the volunteers who are on shift. It also keeps me from being distracted if I work from home. I like to meet the new trainees when they first start, and I always have a chat with them when they're nearing the end of their probationary period. I attend regional and national events and fundraising events that we hold, and I still do ordinary listening shifts because I'm one of those weird people who like being on shift in the middle of the night. When I joined the branch 10 years ago, I never for a moment thought I'd end up as director, but here I am. It's a hugely rewarding role, and I can safely say that I've learned, or have had to learn, many new skills.
How many volunteers are there in the Brighton and Hove branch?
We currently have 202 volunteers.
And do they all respond to people who contact you?
The vast majority of our volunteers are listening volunteers. However, we do have a sturdy group of 27 support volunteers who are involved in fundraising, outreach, admin, and anything else we can find for them, really. We also have a shop in George Street in Hove, and we're always looking for volunteers to work there.
Now, money. How much does it cost to run the branch?
Currently, it costs £144 a day to run the Brighton Hove and District branch. That covers everything from the all-important tea and biscuits to heating, lighting, rates, and, of course, telephone bills.
So how is it financed?
Brighton Hove and District Samaritans is entirely financed by fundraising. Events like the Alison Moye concert are few and far between, so we're always looking for ways that we can raise money. Our shop gives us a good income, and occasionally we'll be successful in bids for grants from large companies. Fundraising is something that we've been focusing on particularly this year, with it being the 50th year of Samaritans in Brighton and Hove.
And so the branch has been going for 50 years and seems to be very successful. Alison, thank you very much for telling us about it, and we'll go and interview some other people now.
Thank you.
So, after talking to Alison, who's currently the director of the Brighton and Hove Samaritans, Maya duly went along to the anniversary party in the hope of talking to some other Samaritan volunteers. As it happened, the first person she met was Mark, who's a comparatively new member of the branch, and Maya began by asking him how long he'd been a Samaritan.
I've been active on the phones for about a year.
So quite new to the job then?
It is, yes. It's still fresh.
How are you finding it?
It's really, really rewarding. I have to say that when you have a call where somebody is distressed at the start and calm at the end, it's such a satisfying thing to do. It's so, so rewarding.
What made you be a volunteer?
I think that people in society, the strong should look after those who are a little bit weak and in need. And if you're feeling that you're strong, then you should help out other people.
And what happens if you feel weak?
It hasn't happened yet. So, yeah, it's one of those things when I wouldn't have done it if I didn't feel that I could do it. If I didn't think I could do it on a particular time, then I wouldn't actually do the shift, or I'd make sure I'd actually stop being a volunteer.
Right, that seems very sensible. What sort of shifts do you do then?
I tend to do 5 to 8 in the morning and 8 to 11 in the evening. And the 5 to 8s can be at the weekends, typically at the weekends, so a Saturday morning at 5 to 8 is quite common.
And what sort of calls do you get there?
You get the whole range of calls. You have people who are very distressed because of bereavement. You have people with mental health problems. And you do, unfortunately, have some calls which are inappropriate first thing in the morning.
And what do you do if you get one of those?
Well, you have to make sure that the person isn't actually in need. So you talk to them. You explore it a little bit, and then you tend to find, if you focus on emotions, that the caller will voluntarily hang up quite quickly.
Did your training prepare you for any of this?
I think the training is superb. The way that you both have sort of the theoretical training where you go through what might happen, but what you also have is a whole series of role plays, and the role plays actually give you a very good insight. Every call is different. Every experience and caller's experience is different, but it does give you a very, very good grounding.
How long did it take you between applying and actually getting on the phones?
It was about 15 months. There were some people who I was training with where it was more like 18 months.
Why was that?
I think it's very sensible. I think they give you a breather to actually decide, once you've had an introduction to the Samaritans, whether it's actually right for you. The training process when I was doing it actually took several months as well. That took about 6 months. You then have a mentoring and a review process, and going through that process just to make sure that it's right for you and you are right for the Samaritans, I think it's eminently sensible that it takes that long.
That sounds as though it's pretty thorough. Do you think it's the sort of thing everybody could do?
I think there are certain skills which are more appropriate for a Samaritan. Listening skills, obviously, being empathetic. I think everybody can help the Samaritans, so even if you're not on the phones, there are an awful lot of things that you can do for the Samaritans.
Such as?
We have a shop, so we can have on that. We have people at events where we need to raise money, so you can actually help out in terms of that. Physically at the centre, we need to have things done to actually just keep the centre physically running. So even if not being a listener is right, there's an awful lot that you can do.
That sounds really good. Thanks very much, Mark.
Maya Davis was talking to Mark, a comparatively new member of the Brighton and Hove Samaritans, about his experiences of his first year taking phone calls. After talking to Mark, Maya managed to catch up with somebody who'd been a member for much longer.
I'm with Sheila now, and Sheila's one of the longest-serving volunteers. How long have you actually been a Samaritan at this branch, Sheila?
It's 32 years next month.
32 years next month? Yes, yeah. My goodness. Have you seen lots of changes in that time?
Yes, a lot of changes. I think mainly technological changes. You know, when I joined, it was just the phone and face-to-face. And now we do those two and emails and texts. And we have computers we have to work as well. So it's changed there a lot. But the callers haven't changed, really. That's still the same.
And you've managed to survive all that time?
Yes.
How do you think you've done it?
I don't know. I think because I wanted to do it, I had to learn. And, you know, if you want to do something, that's what you do. But it's quite easy, really. And I've found it, even me, I could find it quite easy to do when I was taught.
Right. And what sort of experience did you have to make you feel you could actually be a Samaritan?
Well, nothing dramatic, really, but we'd just given up our business and both my daughters were married and I wanted to do something. My friend was in the volunteer bureau and she said, well, why don't you apply to Samaritans? They want somebody. And I thought, oh, I can talk to people, you know, I can solve their problems. Yes, I didn't realise what it entailed.
So it's not solving problems?
Not at all, no. We believe that people should be free to choose what they want to do themselves. I mean, we don't know their situation, we only know what they tell us, and we're not qualified in lots of the problems that they bring to us.
Do you do anything for Samaritans outside the branch?
Well, I help with training, and I do talks, and I go to events, and that's all, yeah.
Yeah. Now, I gather you had a very special reward for everything that you've done for Samaritans.
Yes.
Can you tell me a bit about that?
Well, much to my surprise and confusion, I was chosen to go to a Buckingham Palace garden party this year.
And how did that come about?
Well, it was luck of the draw, really, I think. It wasn't... our branch drew one of the places to go, and people said, well, send her. You know, so that's how it happened, really, which I was very grateful for. Mm.
And what was it like?
It was lovely. A very hot day, that was the only thing. But the grounds were beautiful. Military band playing, jazz band playing. The food was lovely. We waited 90 minutes to see a brief glimpse of Prince Charles and his wife. And then we went home. But it was a lovely experience, yes.
So you don't regret having been a Samaritan for this length of time?
No. I hope I go on a bit longer yet.
So do we. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, so far in the programme, we've been hearing about the 50th anniversary of the Brighton and Hove branch of the Samaritans. But let's take a break from that for the moment, because another, even more important anniversary is coming up very shortly. It's the 100th anniversary of the armistice that ended World War I. And it's on Sunday, the 11th of November. With me in the studio today is Chris English. It's supposedly his week off, but he's come in specially. He's very keen, you know. And Chris, you've been finding out about how this 100th anniversary is going to be celebrated in Brighton and Hove.
Absolutely, because it's such a special anniversary. I went along to the Royal British Legion shop and office in Queen's Road in Brighton and spoke to their manager there, Mark Edwards, and asked him what exactly was happening in Brighton and Hove.
So that we know about in Brighton and Hove, obviously there is the main service up at the Cenotaph and the Old Steam. The War Memorial on the seafront opposite the I-360, they usually have some form of smaller service there where they do lay wreaths. Hove, Grand Avenue is the same. There's a couple of things going on in different bars and restaurants around the city as well, which is quite nice. Bar Broadway in the evening have an amazing singer. She starts at 8 o'clock. Her name's Jenny Castell. And she is quite strongly affiliated with the armed forces through her family. She does like a memorial to olden times and all the old songs and all that sort of stuff, and it's great. She dresses up in a beautiful outfit and it's a really, really nice time. The Amsterdam Bar and Grill on the seafront are doing something similar. They've got a male singer, I believe, from about 5 o'clock, just after they serve lunch. So he's doing something there. And the Royal British Legion ourselves, we are going down to support both of them events because they've requested us to do so. So myself and one of my colleagues will be there for advice and information. That, at the moment, is about it that I definitely know of, because the Royal British Legion are going to be present at these events. The I360, I believe, there's going to be something on their website soon because they want to do a nod to remembrance. I have spoken to one of their guys there, and I believe it's going to be the night before, so it's going to be more of a nod to at the setting of the sun, and in the morning we will remember them. So that's quite a nice way of doing it, because there's a lot of people that get together over the Sunday itself, and there's too many things in the city that everyone can't go to. So for the I360 to do this, it's given people the opportunity to have one of the free rides and all that sort of stuff with the flights that they do, which I believe is actually going to be free to veterans. But check out their website for that, because that should be quite nice.
Talking about veterans, I mean, because it's 100 years ago since the end of the war, presumably there aren't any veterans of that conflict still about.
Not that I know of, and I'll be honest, it would have been fantastic to meet any of these people. The stories and camaraderie that they must have had back then would be great to see coming through to today. So, yeah, we don't know. So this year, I think, it is a huge thing for remembrance, because that's sort of all we've got left, really, is the remembrance of these fantastic people and what they did for us. So, yeah, and if there is anyone out there that is a veteran of the First World War, please, please do let us know, because we'd love to have a chat.
Absolutely. How important is it, 100 years after the event, to continue to remember it?
Extremely. Just as important as the event itself and what actually happened. It is definitely something that should never be forgotten and cannot be forgotten. And with working with the Royal British Legion, that's something that's definitely at the forefront of my mind, to make sure that it's not forgotten and that it's spoken about. There's a lot of people out there that sort of see it as a taboo subject now and are trying to squash the idea of talking about remembrance because they think it glamorises war and all this sort of nonsense. And I think it is absolute nonsense, and I'll always think that. The glamorisation of war has got nothing to do with what we do. This is a remembrance of what the sacrifice of young men, women, animals gave for this country, and it should definitely be remembered. And as long as I'm around, I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that we do.
Well, now let's resume our visit to the 50-year celebrations of the Brighton and Hove Samaritans. A few minutes ago, we heard Maya talking to one of the longest-serving volunteers in the branch, Sheila. And there are quite a few people who join the branch and stay with it for many years. But others have to leave, either because of pressure of work or because of moving out of the area. One such was Michael, who was the next person that Maya spoke to.
I'm now with Michael, who isn't a serving volunteer at the moment. Michael, can you tell me a little bit about when you were a volunteer here?
Yeah, I was a volunteer at Samaritans from 2010 to 2013, when I left Brighton. That is when I stopped being a volunteer for the branch.
What made you join?
I'd always done a bit of volunteer work. And when I moved to Brighton, I didn't really have anything to fill that gap. And then I made a new friend who was a volunteer, and we got chatting about what they did. And they were like, you could do this. And I was like, I can't do this. I definitely can't do this. But she said, yeah, give it a go. Go to an information event. And so I did. And I thought, this sounds actually really interesting and something that I could really get involved in and commit to. It just went from there, and actually it's one of the most rewarding things I've ever done, and I use the training that I received as a Samaritan almost daily.
And how do you use that training then?
It's active listening skills, those kind of ways of really sort of being present and listening to what someone is talking about, but also about how to manage relationships. And if you're dealing with a difficult work situation, the number of times that you could, you know, for example, use learning to leave a silence just is really useful, actually, and you can apply those skills into all different parts of your life.
But you're not volunteering at the moment, are you?
Not at the moment, no. Work kind of got in the way, but I think it will be one of those things that I eventually come back to.
Well, let's hope you do. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
That was Michael, who used to be a volunteer at the branch, but had to give it up due to pressure of work and moving away from the area. But as you hear, he's quite keen to get back in once he has the time. Now, you may picture Samaritans just sitting in an office answering a phone all the time, but as we've already heard, they do all sorts of other things, like answering texts and emails. And they're not just confined to being in the office. They reach out into the community and help vulnerable groups out there. The next person that Maya talked to was Robin, who's very much involved in one of these activities.
Okay, I'm with Robin now. Now, Robin, you've got a job that involves liaising with Lewes Prison, I think. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
That's right. I'm responsible for the team of Samaritans who go into Lewes Prison. We go in every week and we train a team of prisoners to be listeners and to provide a Samaritans listening service to all the other prisoners in Lewes Prison.
And why do you do that?
Prisoners are a group who are among the groups at highest risk of suicide. There's also very high incidence of forms of distress, including mental health issues. So it's really important that we're able to support them.
And you say you're training other prisoners to be listeners. Can you say a bit more about how that works?
Yeah, sure. Prison, obviously, is a very distinct environment, and for people who are in prison, it makes quite a big difference to be able to talk in a confidential, no-advice Samaritan's way to other prisoners, people who know what it's like, know what they're talking about, know the issues that they're raising.
And how do you go about training these listeners?
We have a team in Lewes of about a dozen prisoners who are listeners at the moment. Every so often, we'll run a four-day session in the prison for prisoners who've volunteered to become listeners, and we train them and we take them through all the practicalities and principles of the Samaritans approach, just like Samaritans in the branch generally.
Now, other Samaritans that we've interviewed have talked about the support that's available to the volunteers. What do you do about supporting these listeners?
Well, it's the prisoner listeners who provide the service to other prisoners. We go in, we meet our listeners once a week as a group. We give them the opportunity to debrief, to talk about the calls they've had from other prisoners, and also to support them, to encourage them, and to help them think together about how they can best support the kind of prisoners that they're hearing from.
So does that mean that prisoners don't contact the Samaritans directly, ever?
No, it doesn't mean that. Prisoners have the option of telephoning the Samaritans just like everyone else. And in Lewes, and I think in other prisons, there are phones available on the wings which are adjusted so that they can only dial the Samaritans' number. And some prisoners prefer to phone the number.
So some of them would prefer not to talk to the listeners. They want to talk to Samaritans. Have I got that right?
You have. Sometimes because they think, I think quite often mistakenly, that maybe it's not 100% confidential if they talk to other prisoners. They may just be more comfortable talking completely anonymously outside the context of the prison.
Have you had to have any training to enable you to work with prisoners?
I've had, as the others on our team have had, induction at the prison, including things like self-defence and managing keys and so on. But the practice of learning to work with prisoners as a support for the listeners is really something you do by observation, going along, joining the process as an observer to start with.
How about prison officers? Do you ever need to support them?
The support is there for prison officers. And I've been doing this for about 4 years now, and in that time, I can't remember a direct approach to us from prison officers, but we do take the opportunity to keep giving them the message that Samaritans is a service they can use, which is important because they're in an environment too where distressing things happen.
What happens when prisoners are released from prison? Do they continue to get support?
Many prisoners who are released from prison will, for a period, go from time to time on a regular basis to what are called the approved premises, which in everyday speak I think is a kind of halfway house to help people who've completed their sentence to leave prison fully behind. And there is a Samaritans team that works there too, supporting them when they're at that stage.
But they're different from the prisoner team, is that right?
It's different from the prisoner team, yes.
Great. So Samaritans in Brighton and Hove have been providing support for Lewes Prison and for people who've been released from prison but live in Brighton. Do you do that by yourselves?
We do this as a multi-branch effort, actually, although it's managed from Brighton branch. There's a number of Samaritan volunteers at Eastbourne and now two from Horsham as well. So it's quite a good example of how Samaritan branches can work together on things as well as kind of on their own sort of home turf.
What difference do you think it makes to the prisoners and to the listeners to have the support from Samaritans?
We hear that it makes a huge positive difference. One of the things that we hear from listeners is both positive feedback from other prisoners talking to them, sometimes very powerful, about occasions, for example, when prisoners are new in the prison, where they have been very low and it's really felt like something that's made a difference. And we also hear from listeners that being a listener can be a really positive part of their own experience of prison. Sometimes they will say the most positive thing that's happened to them and something that's really helped them to move them on. And certainly we've had prisoners who've been listeners who have been keen as they approach the end of their sentences to understand how they can be Samaritans at the branch nearest where they're going to live when they come out.
So that sounds as though it's a really positive thing that Brighton and Hove Samaritans do. Would you agree with that?
Completely, yeah. I think it's really important and very positive.
Thank you very much, Robin.
But that isn't the only type of outreach that the Samaritans perform. The person who's in charge of coordinating all these various outside activities is Lisa, whom I spoke to next. And she began by asking Lisa to explain what her role in the branch is.
I'm a volunteer, like the other 200 people at our branch. I also help to run the branch. I'm a trustee of the charity, and I'm deputy in charge of the external relations that we have outside the branch. So things like working with the police, universities, schools, and also organising events that we go to, such as Pride and Trans Pride and Waterstones, wrapping at Christmas, those kind of things.
So can you tell me a little bit more about working with schools and the police and universities, and then maybe a bit about Pride and Trans Pride? Let's take the schools, universities and police first.
Okay. With the police, we like to make sure that they're aware of Samaritans because we work alongside them. And clearly they come across people sometimes in times of distress. So we've recently run a series of sessions for police officers who work in the community in Brighton and Hove, helping them to understand what we do, but also to think about how they might support people who've been affected by suicide or thoughts of suicide. And that was a really useful exercise, we felt, and they did too. Schools, we like to go into the schools across our whole area, so that's Brighton and Hove, but also up to Haywards Heath and over to Lewes and as far as Shoreham, and talk to the young people in years 10 and 11 about what Samaritans do, help them think about the sort of feelings that people might have when they call Samaritans, but also hopefully encourage the young people to think about volunteering as a Samaritan themselves one day. Quite a few show an interest in that. And then as the universities, we do something similar. We go along to freshers' fairs. We also help at the universities if there have been any serious incidents, such as a suicide or an attempted suicide. And we talk to students and we work with staff to make sure we support everybody concerned.
Do you ever give any information away or, for example, tell the police about anybody or pass on any information to schools or from schools and universities?
Well, Samaritans is entirely confidential, so we never, ever discuss our callers. So as I'm talking to you now, I can talk to you in general terms, but I couldn't tell you anything specific about a particular call, because we never, ever do. The only people we speak to are other Samaritans. It's a completely confidential service. There are a very small number of times when we might have to call on the emergency services, such as if somebody says to us, either face-to-face or on one of our calls, that they are frightened of their situation, they want some help, or if they make a bomb threat, something like that. But otherwise, no, we never, ever share information. And it's one of the things I think is most wonderful about Samaritans. It doesn't matter what people tell us. We listen, we don't judge, we don't give them advice, and they can talk to us when they sometimes can't talk to anybody else.
That sounds very good. Now, what about Pride and Trans Pride? How are you involved with those?
Okay, well, what we know is that there are some groups in the population who are at greater risk of suicide than the general population. And people who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or unsure about circumstances for themselves in those areas are at higher risk of suicide. So we're very keen to appear at Pride. This year we're in the Pride Parade. There were 70 of us. And it was wonderful. I think we probably saw about 30,000 people as we marched from Hove Lawns up to Preston Park. And people were waving at us and giving us signals. And we think probably we saw quite a few people who might have called us at some point. At Trans Pride, we had a lovely stall and people came up and one or two people wanted to talk to us about how they were feeling. And that was, I think, a very important occasion. We've done that three times now and we'll be doing it again next year in 2019.
So, to cut a long story short, do you enjoy being a Samaritan volunteer?
I love being a Samaritan. I think it's a very mindful thing to do. For me, going into the centre and doing my shifts, which are 2, 3 or 4 hours long, really focuses me on listening really carefully. And I'll often come away from a shift forgetting what I'd been doing before I went in. And what's also great is we support one another. So at the end of a shift, I speak to another volunteer who's a leader for that shift, debrief to them. It's mostly to check that I'm all right so that I can then go home, come back and do my next shift and be okay. So there's something wonderful about the support we give to one another as well.
Well, that's great. Thank you very much, Lisa.
Maya was talking to Lisa about the Samaritans' methods of outreach into the community. Well, probably the majority of people who phone the Samaritans do so just once when they're in a particular crisis. But there are people who phone many times over a lengthy period and need prolonged support, as Maya was told by one of the other deputies, Susie.
I'm the deputy in charge of caller support, which is a slightly meaningless phrase, but it means supporting the callers who need a little bit extra, who perhaps need to be linked with a particular branch for a short time, 3 months or 6 months, because it helps to get to know them. They may be going through a period of crisis. So we will support them while they're going through that. And the other things that we do, I keep an eye on our email service and our SMS text service, which is very, very, very popular at the moment. Lots of people doing that. And we hope to introduce, in the next year or so, an instant messaging service.
And how's that going to help, do you think?
I think it helps to reach out to more people. So not everybody wants to pick up a phone nowadays, especially young people. It's not how they want to communicate. So for them, a text or an instant message is how they want to talk.
Now, when you say that the support for some callers needs to be a little bit more long-term, does that mean you know who they are and where they live?
No, not at all. The confidentiality is still completely maintained. All we do is we will perhaps offer a caller who's calling a great deal. Perhaps we'll say to them, can we ring you a couple of times a week? And if they say, actually, yes, that'd be very helpful, we'll do that. But no, we don't know their name, we don't know where they live. You know, confidentiality is a real cornerstone of what we do.
And does that go on for a long time?
Rarely. It can do, but I would say that most of that sort of support is about sort of 6 months or so.
How do you think the volunteers cope with dealing with all the callers like this?
There's a system we have which is called a leader system. So for every shift we have open, there is always a leader. And at the end of their shift, the listening volunteer will debrief to the leader. And that's our chance to support them if they've been upset by the call, if they just want to talk it through. And it is a way of supporting and valuing our volunteers.
And do you answer phone calls as well?
I certainly do.
How do you think being a Samaritan has impacted on your life?
I found it enormously worthwhile. Something that is, yes, has had a great impact on my life, but very, very worthwhile. People sometimes ask me if I enjoy it, and I say, enjoy isn't quite the right word. But yes, certainly something that's hugely valuable.
Well, thanks very much indeed, Susie.
Finally, Maya went back to see Alison, who's currently director of the Brighton and Hove branch, and asked her how people could go about finding out more information if they were interested in joining the Samaritans.
There's lots of different ways. If we're at an event that you're at, we will always have leaflets about volunteering, which you can take away. You can phone the helpline number 116 123 and just say you're interested in volunteering, and you'll be contacted and or given the website address. Or you can go straight to the website, which is it's www.samaritans.org, where at the top of the page you'll see a heading of Volunteer with Us. Click on this and it'll take you to a page which will explain more about what being a Samaritan volunteer entails, and then it'll take you to an inquiry form.
Alison, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Maya Davis has been talking to various members of the Samaritans of Brighton and Hove about their work and the 50th anniversary of their foundation. If you are interested in joining the Samaritans, you can find out more by phoning their helpline number, which is 116 123. That's a free phone number, 116 123. Or you can look at their website, which is www.samaritans.org. That's www.samaritans.org. And if you're feeling depressed or lonely or suicidal and you feel it would help to talk to a stranger in confidence and to be completely accepted whatever you say, you can phone the Samaritans. Once again, the number is 116 123. 116 123. Well, that brings us to the end of our programme for this time. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this special edition of At Home This Morning. There'll be another edition in a fortnight's time, which will be presented by Chris English, and I'll be back again in a month's time. But just a reminder that there's also a special edition of At Home This Morning at 8 a.m. on the morning of Sunday, November the 11th, and that'll be on the subject of Remembrance Day. So it now just remains for me, Richard Davis, on behalf of everybody here at Grey Matters Productions, who make this programme, to wish you all the very best. Goodbye.
At Home This Morning has been a Grey Matters production.